Good morning. We're opening up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Today we have a number of bills that are up for public hearing, reconsideration, as well as work sessions. I have members here, and the rules that we work under is we get members in and out because they have other obligations, committees to go to, and that's why we're actually starting late, because I had to be in another committee to testify on another set of bills. So, Representative Olson and Representative Krieger, why don't you two come forward, and we're going to figure out which of the bills you have, and then we're going to go ahead and open up one or two at the same time. And as they're getting settled, if everyone can bear with us, what will happen is that we'll take their testimony, and then we will be closing those public hearings only to reopen them when we get to the point of being able to take additional testimony from others who have come here today. So, Representative Krieger, I understand you may be here on one bill or two?
One bill.
And which one is that?
2636.
All right. We're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3626A.
2636.
Oh, excuse me. How about House Bill 2636A?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2636A exempts employees of the U.S. Department of Agriculture from criminal charges if, in the scope of employment, the employee possesses or discharges a firearm during a lawful taking of wildlife. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Wayne Krieger, State Representative, District 1. Chair and committee, during the interim, I was contacted by a retired sheriff, Mike Cook, in Coos County. And regarding the issue that the wildlife officers employed by the USDA are not those officers that are listed and able to discharge a firearm within an urban area or city. And often in rural Oregon, they do a lot of work around those cities and patrol those areas and get complaints and have to come to those inside the city limits to dispatch an animal, trap an animal, and take care of it. Also, in the times recently down in Ashland, they've had more complaints regarding cougar. Cougar complaints throughout the state are growing, and oftentimes we'll have periods when rabies will jump up in either raccoons or skunks for a period of time, and they need to have that ability to dispatch those officers, those critters. What happens is, in rural Oregon, where you don't have a sheriff or a police officer available, they need to be able to do that because many of the times they don't have one on duty or even one on call. And so this simply allows them to discharge a firearm, and they are properly trained, and that's what the bill really allows to have happen. I think it's common sense.
All right. Any questions for the representative? All right. And I'm just going to find out before you get up, is there anyone who else wanted to give testimony today on the bill that's before us, which is House Bill 2636A. I'm not seeing anyone. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing, open the work session on House Bill 2636A.
Mr. Chair, move 2636A to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2636A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I like that term. I'm going to use it elsewhere, dispatch an animal.
All right.
We got a bill in another committee that works.
Any objection? So ordered. And just for the record, Senator Dingfelder has been excused all day for other matters.
Jeez. We have a carry on.
And on carry on this one,
I'll
Senator Boquist, you want to dispatch this one? All right. We'll close that work session. And Senator, Representative Olson, which of the two bills? I have 2502, and you have another one, I believe.
I do. Mr. Chair, it's 3263, and actually 2502 would probably move the quickest between the
right.
two.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2502A. Council?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2502A authorizes the seizure or production of documents in accordance with a subpoena or warrant from a recipient outside Oregon, regardless of the location where the recipient receives service or where the records are physically located, declares an emergency effective on passage. There is an A4 amendment which conforms to the request of the House Judiciary Committee. It makes language consistent with the bill. And there's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee, my name is Andy Olson. I'm State Representative out of the Albany area. And if I could have Michael Slauson come up with me from the Attorney General's office, because he helped craft some of this as well. But if you if you recall, especially Senator Bonamici, this is a bill that originally started 2 years ago with the discretion, giving discretion back to the courts for traffic violations for minimum mandatory fines. And that's where 2502 originally started until we found out what the fiscal was going to be this session. And as a result of that, we've moved a little bit with it. And you have the version in front of you right now, 2502. But it relates to existing criminal process authorizing the seizure or the production of business records in criminal matters. This legislation is modeled after a bill that passed unanimously in the Washington State Legislature last year. I'm not going to read my written testimony entirely to you, mainly because you have it in front of you, and I do believe it would be good for you to move forward quickly with things. But this is what the bill accomplishes, three key objectives, and then also just want to go into detail section four of it. It allows prosecutors and defense attorneys to obtain out-of-state business records that are relevant to a criminal case in Oregon. It allows for admissibility of records verified by records custodian without testimony. And it eliminates requirement that police officers be present for execution of search warrants on businesses. And I think Mr. Slosson will kind of fill in the gaps there for you. But the final piece that I just want to share with you, and this makes sense too, because Mr. Chair, you being part of the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Committee, you'll understand this. Section 4 makes a moderate change to ORS 131-588. It, currently, the law authorizes the court to pay restitution to victims of crimes if the conviction is a person, felony, or person class A misdemeanor. This has been a problem, and let me give you an example. A suspect takes or embezzles money from a victim, then uses that money to purchase property. The current law allows for that property to be subject of criminal forfeiture. Here lies the problem. The DA's office is unable to return any proceeds to the victim as a result of the criminal asset forfeiture. And what Section 4 of House Bill 2502 does is provide the state the ability to make the motion before the court should there be any proceeds from a criminal forfeiture that a portion of the proceeds be directed as restitution to the victim. That's a simple fix, and it absolutely makes sense.
Anything else to add?
Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee, my name is Michael Slosson. I'm a senior assistant attorney general in the Oregon Department of Justice. I'd be very happy to kind of go over the more details if that's helpful to the committee. On the criminal process portions of this bill, the Department of Justice strongly supports it. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, let's see if there are any questions. I think it's pretty straightforward. Basically, what we're trying to do is have a way of expediting getting records from out of state and not requiring the formalities that we would require. And then my understanding in some of these cases would include like bank records or other type of documentation that some corporation who's housed outside of the state, and we're trying to gather those for conduct or trial within this state. Is that correct?
Chair Brzozinski, that's correct. It could be something like Yahoo, something like that.
Right. All right. Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Brzozinski. Who would execute the search warrants on the businesses?
Hi, Chair Brzozinski, Senator Wissett. In the cases in which the business is not being investigated, what would happen is that the officer would contact that business, say it's Yahoo, and coordinate with Yahoo. We would get the search warrant in this state. It wouldn't be sent to Yahoo, and Yahoo would conduct the search on its own servers and report back the information it located.
I don't think I followed that. I'm sorry.
Chair Brzozinski, Senator Whitsett. So right now, let me give you an example. Under federal law, under the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, you have to have a search warrant for the content of certain electronic communications, like, let's say, an email. Mm-hmm. So say we're doing a child exploitation investigation, and there's an email relevant to that investigation that's sitting on a server in Yahoo's servers in California. Well, the federal law requires us as prosecutors to get a search warrant to access that email. But under current state law, only officers can execute search warrants except for bank records. There's an exception currently in law for bank records. Those have to be served like a subpoena. What this bill does is sort of apply that same process for other businesses like Yahoo so that the officer can serve the search warrant by mailing it or faxing a copy to Yahoo so Yahoo can look on its own servers and provide that information. It's just no way where an officer be able to, even if Yahoo's in the state, to be able to search the servers of Yahoo, similarly like with the bank. That's why that's currently in the bank records law.
And the officer would serve the search warrant by mail, fax, whatever, and the company would comply with it on their own.
Chair Brzozowski, Senator Whitsitt, yes, that's correct. Again, the same pattern for banks currently.
Thank you.
All right, Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Olson and Mr. Slauson, I just want to confirm something that's on the staff measure summary. This doesn't affect the opposing party's ability to challenge the authenticity of the document. Is that correct?
Chair Brzozowski, Senator Bonamici, that's correct. Definitely, there's different ways to challenge it. Right now, there's a provision in there to make it so you don't have to have a custodian of records if the other party agrees to that, if the other party does have an opportunity to challenge that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, I just want to point out too to you, we did have a little bit of a work group to put this together to where we're at, and Gail Myers from OCDLA was involved and supported where we're now moving with the Dash 4s. Michael was a huge contributor with that, Dinah Vidlins, as well as the DA over in Crook County.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. And I'm just going to check to see if there's anyone else who wanted to give testimony on this bill, which is 2502, just so I know it doesn't have anyone else signed up. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing. We can't work this bill since we just got the Dash 4. We're waiting for the paperwork on that. And
you want to put the Dash 4s in so we get the right fiscal?
Sure, let's do that. We'll go ahead and open up the work session. And
Mr. Chair, move the A4 into 2502.
Senator Boquist moves the A4 into House Bill 2502. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And we'll close that work session, and we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing. And excuse me, that was on which one was that?
3263.
And, all right, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3263 extends the statute of limitations for certain sex crimes if defendant is identified on the basis of DNA sample comparisons. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. And what we're going to do is take Representative Olson's testimony. We'll come back to this one because I actually have another committee counsel that will be handling that bill. Plus, we have a number of other people I believe will be testifying. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Again, my name is Andy Olson, state representative out of the Albany area. And thank you for listening to this. House Bill 3263 extends the statute of limitations for certain sex crimes if a suspect is identified on the basis of DNA sample comparisons. And the chief co-sponsors on this myself, Jeff Barker, the chair on Judiciary on the House side, and Wayne Krieger, who you just listened to here a few moments ago. And all three of us are retired from different police agencies. This bill would extend the statute of limitations indefinitely for certain crimes where a DNA sample was collected at a crime scene and at a later time the offender is identified on the basis of that sample. And the following crimes are the ones that are impacted by this bill. First-degree rape, first-degree sodomy, first-degree unlawful sexual penetration, and first-degree sexual abuse. This bill truly seeks justice for the victim. Earlier this month, over on the House Judiciary Committee, we had the opportunity to listen to testimony from three ladies who had been raped while they were teenagers. And I believe that they're all three here today. So I'm not going to go into detail for that. Tiffany Edens, Leonard, Danielle Tudor, Colleen Kelly, they're truly very courageous ladies from what I have seen and observed. Mr. Don Reese as well from Multnomah County DA's office will be here along with Steve Dole too from Crime Victims United to share and give you further rounding out of what this bill is all about.
All right, thank you. Any questions for the representative? Andy, thank you very much for being here. I'm going to go ahead and close on a temporary basis the public hearing on 3263, I believe. And counsel, we're going to go ahead and work these other three that are yours. Or other two, I guess, at this point. So we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing. We'll start with House Bill 2713A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2713A is known as the Public Safety Officer Bill of Rights. It basically requires public agencies to adopt written procedures for investigating public safety officers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. And gentlemen, whoever wants to start off.
For the record, Brian Galagna, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations. Very simple bill. It's modeled after legislation in a number of other states, including California, in which you have uniform statewide standards for how a police officer is investigated, what rights they should have during that. You can go through that, but I don't know how much detail you want to go through. But it talks about that they could be interviewed during the waking hours or their normal work shift. They can't be interviewed longer in a certain period of time. They can't be deprived of food or the ability to go to the restrooms, those kinds of things. In working through this bill on the House side, we did a lot of work. There was conversations between my organization and the chief's organization as well. The bill passed out of committee with one no vote. That was a concern about whether or not if there was a contract in place, and then you also had the state standard, which one actually applied actually during that time period of the expiration of the contract and the renewal of a new contract that would incorporate these particular provisions. We have worked with the help of the chair. He actually brought us together on another bill, and we continued the conversation. We have now worked that out. You do not have the amendments in front of you yet. I believe not. They were only submitted yesterday. But we now have full agreement on the bill, and with that, I'll answer any questions if you have any.
All right. Kevin?
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Campbell, Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and want to express my appreciation to Brian and his folks. We did sit down and made progress and resolved some issues, and we are now on board the bill with the amendments. As Brian mentioned, the ability to clarify for a supervisor what rules if one of these instances occurs, whether it's the contract or the state law, is resolved now in the amendment, so that we know that when the contract expires, the new law will certainly be the floor then moving forward if they don't already have those provisions. But what we wanted to avoid was a situation where they had two standards they were trying to deal with, trying to determine which one was in play. And so with the amendments, we believe that's resolved. They were also gracious enough to talk through some other adjustments that we think improve or just clarify the language. And with that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we can support the bill.
All right. Well, thank you very much. When we get the amendments, I would expect you both to review them, make sure they have the meeting of the minds, and then we can move forward, and that will be sometime next week. Colleagues, any questions? Senator Wissett?
I just had one. It appears that the... as I read it, if the officer is off duty during the interview, they must be compensated at the normal rate. That means that you can't really have a discussion with them regarding discipline or whatever without paying them for that time.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that language is actually being slightly modified in the adjustments that they had suggested. But what that does mean is that if you bring them in to talk to them about an internal investigation, they need to be compensated while they're being brought in.
And Chair Przanski and Senator Wissett, I don't think it requires payment for a conversation, but in these instances, it's clear there's a disciplinary procedure that's progressing, and so it's not a vague conversation that now we have to pay for, but it really is becoming a process that in this environment, the officer and whoever is interviewing in this case understand that there's basically the potential for dismissal or other kinds of economic sanctions, and so it is pretty clear in this environment when that kicks in, and it's something that we're comfortable with from the chief's perspective.
All right. Any other questions? If not, then let me just see if anyone else wanted to be signed up to give testimony on 2713. Not seeing anyone, I want to go ahead and close the public hearing with the understanding that the bill will be coming back for our work session once we get those amendments. With that, we're going to open up our next public hearing, which is on House Bill 2629A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2629A imposes an additional fee for committing crimes of interfering with or assaulting a police animal. There's no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact, and no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. I have Mayor Pohl, I believe it's Ray Pohl, and then Jim Hogan.
Mayor Diane Pohl. No, oh, yeah, right.
Sorry. 629.
Chair Prusansky and committee. My name is Mayor Diane Pohl from the city of Clatskanie. I apologize. We had Officer Ike, our canine, was supposed to come this morning and be here as well, but we had a major burglary last night. He was on scene tracking, and so he's tied up in a hopefully arrest by the time we get home. And this is one of the things that I came to testify on, is to tell you a story about a small community that was so highly impacted with drugs and crime that it took matters into its own hands and through a public-private partnership has one of the most outstanding and successful canine programs that I know of. 4 years ago, 4.5 years ago, one of our beloved citizens, a retired sheriff out of Clatsop County, was shot to death by a meth addict. I then became mayor and asked our police chief if there was any way that we could find a drug dog or some kind of help, because what's happened is in our war on drugs, as federal assistance declines, as state law enforcement declines, it's up to the communities to try and face this issue head on. Being so close to Longview, Washington, one of the major drug capitals of our area, we were highly impacted in our small city with the drug problem. I looked at this city budget. It wasn't in the cards. I went to the community. We started an Adopt a Canine project. In 2 months, our small community of 1,800 people and surrounding areas raised $34,000, and we were able to purchase a dual-trained dog, and we have had a very successful program since. Ike, our office canine officer, has over 300 drug fines so far under his belt. One drug dealer decided to try and get by him, so they hollowed out beef sticks and filled it with heroin, and thinking that they could get past Ike, and they couldn't. He found it immediately upon the stop. The thing in Oregon that is beneficial to have a drug dog for is because it's probable cause when the officers make a stop to search a car or to have the dog, if the dog alerts on that car, then to search that car. And that is a very, very important piece of this. Law enforcement informants tell us now, don't go to Clatskanie because of Ike. Go around it. And that's what we want. That's what the community wanted. This is not just a dog that the city bought and foisted upon the community. This is a dog that the community bought and loves dearly. And for that reason, we looked at what the penalties were for harming a canine officer, and you could get just kind of a little bit more by spitting on the sidewalk. So,
Jim Colvin, to my right, went to Representative Witt and Senator Johnson and asked that penalty
be increased. Our law enforcement officers face dangers every day. Canine officers are bred and trained to lay their lives down in the protection of their handlers and the communities they serve. And the very least we owe them is to pass laws that make it very punitive to harm them. They're not just animals. They serve and protect. And this particular bill does not, it increases the fine for harming a police animal. These animals are becoming more and more of a target as drug dealers are finding that they are effective. I will tell you that we're dealing with a new drug on the scene right now that's called cheese. It's coming up from Mexico, and it's coming in from the east, and it's a combination of meth and heroin. And it's very, very dangerous. We need this resource. We need this tool in our toolbox, and we need to make it punitive.
Thank you, Mayor Pohl. Mr. Hogan, do you have other testimony you'd like to add to this?
My name is Jim Hogan, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. I'm also from Clatskanie. I want to thank Senator Johnson and Representative Witt for introducing this bill. It's historically, legislators that have tried to improve the lot of law enforcement animals have...
Mr. Hogan, we have a number of other bills, and I appreciate that you want to give credit to the to those members, but I'm going to ask you to summarize your testimony because I have a full room of other people who would like to be testifying on some other bills as well today. I apologize for the rush, but the reality is I need to try to get all their testimony in today, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'll summarize then.
That'd be great.
People are under the illusion, mistakenly in Oregon, that we do a good job of protecting our law enforcement animals, and nothing could be further from the truth. We are the worst west of the Rockies in protecting these animals, and this is one. This bill is one tool to add to our toolbox, and, but we have a ways to go. So I'd appreciate if this committee would pass this along with a do-pass recommendation, and we'll be back to finish this project in another session.
All right. Thank you. Questions? Senator Wissett.
Thank you. Just one short question. Does this, would this law, if passed, include attack dogs, dogs that are trained to take people down?
It would include all certified police dogs and horses or any other law enforcement animals, yes.
And then would it, in fact, be punitive for someone who was trying to defend themselves against a dog taking them down?
I am not an attorney, Senator Whitsitt, and excuse me, Chair Prezansky, Senator Whitsitt. I am not. I would assume that that would be a civil matter. That would, if the dog harmed someone in the arrest, I think that there are procedures through civilly that that can be handled.
No, that wasn't the question. If the person who was being taken down harmed the dog in his effort to defend themselves, would that be a criminal matter?
Chair Prezansky, Senator Whitsitt, I cannot answer that accurately. And so rather than not accurately, I can't answer.
Yeah. Senator Whitsitt, what I would assume is if it could be shown that the dog in this case was using unreasonable force, just as if it was a police officer, there could be the ability for them, meaning the individual, to protect themselves to meet the unreasonable force. That would be a question for the jury, and of course, both in the criminal side, if there were charges, and also civilly, if they decided to bring some type of a suit against the, in this case, the city. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you all very much. I'm sorry for the rush on getting the testimony in. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on 2629A? We'll close the public hearing. And counsel?
I think
3263. All right. And thank you. I'm going to reopen House Bill 3263. And if we can get the sign-up sheets, and Courtney, if you can bring the rest of the sign-up sheets for the other bills so we can maneuver those into the process. All right, I'm going to call at this time Steve Dole and Steve Anderson. You have two individuals you'd like to have come up with you. If you please ask them to come forward. And I'm assuming, Steve, it's Tiffany and Colleen that will be coming forward?
It's Tiffany and Danielle.
And Danielle, okay.
Mr. Chair, Colleen could not be here today.
Okay, thank you. And you'd like to get us started.
Mr. Chair, I'll make my comments brief just to introduce the witnesses. When in the state of Oregon, they lose their life. When an individual is raped in the state of Oregon, they many times lose their soul. Some come through it, some don't. We have two witnesses today who have been down this road and through this valley and are very brave women in my estimation, and they're here to tell you about their experience as it applies to 3263. So with that, I'll hand it over to whoever's going to go first.
Yeah. I'd like to go first. If you would just give us your name before you give us the testimony, please.
Okay, my name is Tiffany Edens, and I wanted to say thank you to the committee for hearing this, House Bill 32, and thank you, Chair Przanski. I'm just going to read something that shouldn't take very long. On December 5th of 1986, my life was turned upside down in a matter of 5 to 7 minutes. I was raped by Richard Troy Gilmore. After 2 weeks from the night that he raped me, he was apprehended with Gresham Police Department and Multnomah County Police Department. They had found out that Richard Troy Gilmore was an applicant to become a Gresham police officer. He had applied for the position before he raped me and was actively pursuing the position after he raped me. Also, they found out that he was the jogging rapist. He had committed 9 other rapes against other teenage girls in the late 70s and early 80s. For those young victims like Danielle and Colleen, they had no answers and their parents had no answers. It had been 6 years, I think you were raped in 1980. 79. Okay, so it was 7 years until they had an answer to this vicious and heinous crime committed against her. I couldn't believe at 14 years old that this man who had admitted these crimes was not going to be prosecuted. It was shocking and disheartening. I couldn't imagine being a victim of a crime like that and not getting justice. Rape should not be like a child's game of hide and seek with time limits. The winner is the person that can't be found. Put yourself in the place of any rape victim. Is it justice that a serial rapist of multiple children be charged with one rape because he was able to hide? The circumstances of the night I was raped has propelled us here to correct this unjust law. This new law could work as a deterrent for someone yet not a rapist. The citizens of Oregon would know that the act of rape could never hide long enough and could always be punishable. The predator could never play hide and seek from justice in Oregon. The passing of time should not erase a crime like that. I believe that the current statute of limitations says to the victims of Oregon, being raped and sexually abused is not important. That there is a time limit to the validity of the crime against you. Get over it. Time heals all wounds. I received justice for the crime committed against me, and I have been adversely affected since that night. I can't imagine how so many victims in Oregon who have not yet received justice must feel. Thank you to all of the committee members.
Thank you for coming forward. Thank you for being willing to give us your testimony today.
Thank you.
My name is Danielle Tudor, and I'd like to thank the committee for hearing our testimony today, and Senator Przanski, Chair. You have a paper in your hand that you were given that has my testimony on it. And as I was thinking about this hearing today, Chair Barker, when we went before the House, said something that really made me think. And what he said, he thanked us for coming and said, so many times you have bills that come before you and there's never a name or a face or a person that gets associated with that bill, but you perhaps see a chart, you know, that has numbers, percentages. And so I chose today to depart a little bit and share more from my heart what I have experienced over It's been almost 30 years now since I was attacked. So bear with me. It's a little difficult to do, but nonetheless, I would like to give you more of a view and insight to what I'm thinking and what I'm feeling. Like I said, I've been asking myself, over the past few weeks, who am I? How am I different from 30 years ago? And what's brought me here today regarding House Bill 3263? It's been a time to pause and reflect on what's brought me here, and it seems impossible that it's been almost 30 years since I was attacked by Richard Gilmore. So many memories are burned into my mind from that night that at times I still relive some of those thoughts and feelings, but somehow I find the strength from within to push those fears away and live for this moment and time and not the past. As I said, my name is Danielle Tudor. I've been married for almost 28 years to a man who's comforted me through some of my life's darkest hours with his strength and compassion. I have two sons. My oldest son will graduate from college next year with a degree in music technology and business. I'm a grandparent. I have a 4-year-old grandson. My youngest son proudly serves our country in the military and just recently returned from his first tour of duty in Afghanistan. I have a job. I work. I volunteer in the community. I volunteer in my church. And both myself and my husband love to serve people and do what we can to help others. I consider my life to have been blessed and still is blessed. And the reason I'm here today is not because I'm angry or bitter or resentful about my attack or the lack of injustice in my case, but rather to offer you an opinion based on what I experienced firsthand. There are many steps in the process of healing after being raped, and one of those is seeing your attacker brought to justice. There's no span of time that will erase the memory of that night. It was a night where my innocence was stolen from someone who had no right to take it. The further injustice was the fact that Richard Gilmore could admit to my rape, but never be charged for his crime. I understand that the statute of limitations is 25 years. Keep in mind, I am approaching the 30-year mark, and if my attacker were not caught until today, I would still seek justice. People have said that as time goes by, you forget details, places, people, circumstances surrounding your attack. How I wish, and I'm sure Tiffany as well, how I wish that were true. Unfortunately, as a victim, you are never free of those details for the rest of your life. You put yourself in a place where you can receive healing and forgiveness, but the memory stays. It's as if we think there's a switch in our brain that we can block the trauma of the past, but that switch does not exist. Each one of us has to figure out how to best take a negative experience and turn it into something good. For me personally, House Bill 3263 is a good that comes from my experience. This bill is not only for me, but thousands like me, and unfortunately the thousands who will come after me. I am just someone who has taken the challenge to take on a bill that will assure future victims the right to justice. I have become a name, face, and most importantly, a voice to this bill because my own voice could not be heard or find justice 23 years ago when Richard Gilmore was brought to trial. Myself and others provided key evidence for his arrest, but he would not be charged with our attacks because the statute of limitations had already passed. The next best alternative is to take the necessary steps to make sure that future victims will not suffer the same injustice. Previously, I told you who I am and what has brought me to this place today. I did so because I want you to know I am just your average, everyday citizen who deserves to be protected. I speak to you from a voice of reason and for what is right. Our laws should not protect the guilty, but rather the innocent. I speak to you as if it is one of your loved ones who has experienced the injustice of a legal system which should have protected them. At least four of Richard Gilmore's victims were minors, myself included. One victim committed suicide. Tragically, we will never know the full ramifications of her assault and how that may have played a role in her decision to take her own life. My own heart is filled with compassion for not only the victims of Richard Gilmore who cannot join us today for this hearing, but for women and children all over our state who have suffered the trauma of rape. If it were possible to speak to each victim individually right now, I would tell them there is hope, there is life worth living, and most of all, we care. I have been fortunate enough to come out on the other side, and so can they. My plea to you today, to this committee, is that you would see the necessity of House Bill 3263. The public needs to be assured that sex offenders such as Richard Gilmore will be brought to justice when caught with proper evidence. I ask that you send a strong message to those who are responsible for such violent acts against women and children that will make the most brazen think twice before committing this type of crime. We can only assume that a no statute of limitations law for first-degree sex crimes will become a deterrent to those who entertain the idea of committing such an act. I'd like to thank you for listening to me today and giving me the chance to speak on behalf of House Bill 3263. And as I said before, I've taken the risk of following my own heart this morning, exposing some deep and personal thoughts. But my hope and goal is that whether you have signed on to this bill or not, it's that you too would take pause, put yourself in my shoes, act and respond as if you or a loved one was a victim of Richard Gilmore. They reported their attack, went through the proper legal channels, only to have their voice not heard, but rather extinguished, not because of lack of evidence, but because time dictated that they should not see justice. I'd like to thank you for your time, and if you have any questions, I would be happy to answer any of those. Thank you.
All right, questions for anyone on the panel?
All right, I want to thank you both, and Daniel, speaking from your heart, that means so much for all of us and for you to come forward, as well as Tiffany, and sorry that Colleen wasn't able to make it, but I would tell you that you represented her very well today. So there's no questions. Thank you for coming forward. I have three other people that are listed here that want to give testimony. Don Rees, Andrea Meyer, and Gail Meyer. Mr. Rees, I'm going to let you go first.
Thank you. Chair Prozonsky, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Don Rees. I'm a senior deputy district attorney from Multnomah County. I supervise the Violent Crimes Unit. I'm also a member of the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. The executive director of the task force, Christine Herman, could not be here this morning, but she submitted a letter and to highlight two points from her letter. One, she wanted to emphasize that there was no agreement in the last legislative session by the task force that this issue would not be raised again. Two, House Bill 3263 is not revolutionary in the sense that 14 states have already enacted similar legislation, and an additional 12 states have gone even far beyond what's being proposed. In 12 states, they have eliminated the statute of limitations for serious sex crimes, whether there's DNA evidence or not. Under House Bill 3263, where identity of the perpetrator is based on DNA, there would be an elimination of the statute of limitations. So by definition, this would affect the victims who are either the victims of forcible compulsion, children, or those who are physically incapacitated, the victims of first-degree sex crimes. DNA evidence, as you all know, is very powerful. It can be used to clear the innocent. It can be used to convict the guilty. But it is essentially with very little value unless there can be a match made between the DNA left on the victim of a sexual assault and a particular individual. And it is often the case that although investigators may have DNA evidence along with other evidence of a crime, that there is no match, that the perpetrator is not in the national database. And a person may commit serial crimes and avoid ever being caught, identified, and having their DNA collected. Unless and until the DNA is collected from that individual, there can be no match, and the crime is not solved. And so it may be that simply because of the passage of time, a serial rapist would escape justice. What's proposed here, given the unique quality of DNA evidence, is an opportunity to bring these people to justice despite the passage of time. As you probably know, the reason for a statute of limitations is because of this notion that goes back over 200 years that in fairness to the accused, there needs to be an opportunity for a fair defense, and that with the passage of time, memories fade, evidence may be lost, and that it is only appropriate that there be some time limit on when the state can take prosecutorial action. And the traditional exception has been for murder, because the thought is that crime is so grave that the interest of justice outweighs the interest of the defendant. Of course, that notion came long before we had DNA evidence. The unique quality of DNA evidence is that it does not change with the passage of time. And so there's no need to worry about the fading of memory when it comes to identifying the perpetrator. This statute would not affect those crimes where there's an alibi defense, where the defense is some other person did it. It's narrowly focused at those instances where it is a stranger-on-stranger sex crime and the identity needs to be proven by DNA. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Whoever wants to go next.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon, here to raise some concerns about this bill, but I want to be clear.
You are not here to defend Richard Gilmore or anyone like him, or the atrocities
that he or others do, but rather to raise some concerns in the system that is important to all of us to ensure that the guilty and the innocent are not one and the same, but that we actually are successful in making sure that both are exonerated or, in the case of the guilty, are convicted. As you've heard, there is a tremendous power of DNA and the science to use it to both convict and to exonerate. But we have concerns about removing the statute limitations in our judicial system. And over the years in Oregon, there has been an incremental change, and I'm not going to go over the history just alone in the last few years before this legislative body. And each time we have raised concerns, and each time there are compelling arguments made as to why it should be changed, and each time there are real victims, and we would never challenge that. But the statute of limitations has provided some important safeguards. It's premised on making our criminal justice system work at the same time that it does allow the victim to confront the accuser. It allows the accuser to call witnesses and prepare a defense. As we let more time elapse between the crime and the accused being tried, it becomes more difficult for the accused to prepare a meaningful defense, let alone any kind of defense. Memories are lost, witnesses have died, and the exculpatory evidence is either no longer available or is not in a condition to aid. The science of DNA is powerful, but with the science comes human involvement and the potential for human error. When DNA is handled correctly, it is a powerful and accurate tool, but DNA still does rely on human scientific skill. DNA is typed computer-generated graph that displays a series of peaks and corresponding alleles, short repeating segments. Everyone has segments, but they vary in length. But ambiguity can arise when interpreting these graphs, especially in cases where there is a mixture of two or more DNA sources. While errors can happen and have happened at any time, handling, labeling, or storing DNA, the ability of the defense to establish an error becomes increasingly more difficult, if not outright impossible, as decades have passed and the DNA testing has already been done. The DNA has been stored for decades, and it may not be possible to retest the DNA at the time that the defendant is finally caught, or the accused, rather, and defendants, who, because DNA degrades even under the best preservation policies. That means, in that case, if it's 30 years later, it's literally impossible to uncover any error in handling or sampling at that time, and we are relying most likely exclusively on DNA. There is often little evidence in cold cases, in fact, other than the DNA match. That's why they're cold cases. And until they get that DNA hit that we hope is accurate, it is a cold case and there's necessarily no other evidence to rely. Not only are the witnesses and memories then gone, but so too are the law enforcement and lab personnel who are responsible for collecting and retaining the evidence. We have been generally fortunate in Oregon that our lab and our system has worked, but there are horror stories across this country, and they only were discovered well after the time that the lab personnel, the DNA was either improperly mishandled, intentionally mishandled, negligently mishandled, and we only know that when it's uncovered. What we don't know probably hurts us too. We hope that such errors will not happen in many cases, but we know that while the power of DNA has exonerated the innocent, it has also been used to convict the innocent. Excuse me. It's exonerated and it's convicted the innocent as well as convicting the guilty. We have documentation around this country where DNA was misread and mishandled despite alibi witnesses testifying. The science of DNA is so powerful it outweighs in our society the sense that it is ever wrong, and that alibis are not sufficient for people to establish their innocence. So we compound this error with decades past, and the unlikelihood of uncovering the mistakes and finding the witnesses becomes next to impossible. In those cases, it's the innocent person that we worry about not being able to mount the defense to challenge the DNA science if it is wrong. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Gail?
Thank you. Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, my name is Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We would just join in the comments made by the ACLU, and we would also like as well to give our due respect to the courage and to the articulation of the victims of Mr. Gilmore. That is not an instance that we like to see repeated again and again. What I do know is the history of the extending and lengthening of the statute of limitations as it relates to sex crimes particularly. At the time of the commission of the Gilmore rapes, the statute of limitations was 3 years for all crimes. And then that has been extended throughout the years to 6 years, and then with minors it's been extended beyond that. And then the first time that the legislature extended the DNA, extended the statute of limitations because of DNA evidence was in 2001, when the legislature extended the statute of limitations from 6 years to 12 years where identity was established through DNA. Just last session in 2007, there was this identical bill that was submitted for consideration, which was when there's establishment of an identity of an offender through DNA, to just get rid of the statute of limitations entirely. It would have gone from 12 years to none at all. There was at some point then in the consensus agreement reached by stakeholders that they would rest on the 25-year mark. And so the Governor's Sex Abuse Task Force was part of this agreement, was the ACLU, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers, the District Attorneys Association, and the Department of Justice. So just last session, two years ago, in looking at this very same issue, the legislative body and its stakeholders rested on a statute of limitation period of 25 years. So the question really is, what's wrong with that decision that the legislative body made 2 years ago? Why move it? I don't know that we've heard compelling reasons. There are times when the true story does need to be told. Establishing the identity in a sexual encounter doesn't tell you all the facts of that in sexual encounter, and I would submit to the committee that 25 years is about as far as the body should go. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel?
I have
comments. All right. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just two things for the record. I mean, we've been asked previously to release individuals based on DNA evidence. Swords have two sides, so as far as I'm concerned, whether you release them or convict them, you got both sides of the swords. And the second thing I'd like for the record is that in the case of whatever lobbyists made whatever deal or whoever made whatever deal whenever that I have no clue about, the Constitution gives at least citizens the right of redress before the legislature. And as I look at the bill, this isn't a lobbyist bill. This is a bill brought forth by four citizens of the state of Oregon. And they are due redress regardless of whatever deal was made by lobbyists.
Any other comments? Senator Bolognici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask whether the concerns, Ms. Meyer, but also Mr. Reese, there were concerns that were raised about the reliability and handling and that type of thing of the DNA. This bill does not extinguish the ability to challenge those concerns if they're raised at a trial. Is that correct?
Chair Prozonsky, Senator Bonamici, no, it certainly doesn't diminish the defense's ability to raise concerns, but, and I've not been a defense practitioner, but it would be my understanding if a case were current that you would have your own scientists test the evidence, as did Mr. Mayfield's attorneys for that fingerprint to try to analyze it from your scientist perspective to ensure that it was handled and done correctly. And that chance is lost potentially if the DNA, as I said, even with preservation, DNA continues to degrade. And so it may not be testable 30, 35, 40 years ago. And so no one can challenge it because the defense has no basis to challenge that it was improperly tested, or the results were improper. They have no basis. There's a scientific result that was done 30 or 40 years ago, and it's reliable unless it can be shown that it isn't, and there's no evidence if we can't test it to suggest that the results found by that particular scientist were wrong, it was mixed, it was misread, the technology is now even more advanced to better understand. And so that's the concern, is a significant delay of time. If the evidence hasn't degraded and it allows for full testing, that's certainly the opportunity then for the defense counsel to ensure that. But DNA evidence alone, depending on the types of crimes, doesn't tell the whole story, and that's where alibis and witnesses and better understanding of what happened at events is so important. And that is lost, so we will be relying on the DNA, right or wrong, to lead a decision and lead a conviction.
Follow up?
Yes.
Briefly? Mr. Chair, thank you. The way I read the statute, there's still the provision in subsection 9 about how whenever the case is brought, it still needs to be commenced within 2 years of the DNA-based identification of the defendant. So there would still be the ability to question whomever did the actual identification. That is not lost. So does that alleviate some of the concerns, perhaps?
Do you want to address that?
Chair Prozanski, Senator Bonamici, if I can address that question and also your previous question, because to be clear, this proposed statute merely allows the state the ability to move forward with a prosecution, the state would nonetheless still be required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt each and every element of the criminal offense, identity being one of those, which would be proved by DNA. As to the reliability or unreliability of the DNA, that would be a question for the trier of fact, the judge or the jury, and would be subject to testing, analysis, and testimony. If it was the case that somehow the DNA was degraded or confused, the state's case would ultimately fail. But I'm sure you're aware anecdotally of instances where scientists using DNA evidence in non-forensic settings, in anthropology, for example, or in identifying the war dead from World War II or beyond, they've been able to show that this is reliable evidence and does have integrity. But in no way, if a person so charged, would they be in a situation where they could not defend themselves. That would all be a question for the trier of fact. As to the two-year limitation, what that means is once the state becomes aware of the identity of the perpetrator, the clock begins to tick, and the state must take action then within 2 years. It can't sit back and wait once there's been a match made by DNA.
All right. I want to need to wrap this up. Ms. Meyer, did you have anything that you want to respond?
I don't.
Oh, wait.
All right. Thank you very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony who has not signed up for House Bill 3263? Not hearing anyone. Thank you all very much for coming forward. We'll close the public hearing, and we're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing. Okay. What I'm going to do on this one here, I'm going to be carrying over a number of bills. This one here, we're carrying over till Tuesday, the 26th. So we'll just put that on the record for people know where we're going with that. And before we do the next public hearing, I'm going to just give notice for those who may be in the room. House Bill 2246A is going to be carried over until May 26th as well. And also on House Bill 2441A, that also will be carried over until Tuesday, May 26th. So if you're here on those bills, those two bills, you may want to make arrangements to come back on this next Tuesday. All right, so now we're going to hold.
First one of those two?
It's going to be 2246A, and then the last one that's on our agenda, which was a carryover from yesterday, 2441A. We're going to go ahead and open up the last one that council has is 2874A. Don't think we've opened that one yet.
House Bill 2874A allows victims to assert the right to a speedy trial and creates procedures for asserting the right to a speedy trial. Had no revenue, impact a minimal fiscal with no statement issued.
All right, Steve, Doug, and I know Harker Road will be up here shortly. Why don't you two go ahead and get started, and if he comes up, we'll get his testimony, we'll come back to it. And also, Gil Meyer signed up for this one, too. Steve?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Dole, Crime Victims United of Oregon. Justice delayed is justice denied. It is proper and fitting that criminal defendants have federal and state speedy trial rights. Individuals with interest in a criminal justice proceeding should be able to expect that there will not be unreasonable delay. In the last two legislative sessions, the Oregon legislature has emphatically adopted the idea that victims also have interests in the criminal justice system. First, in the last session, the Oregon House and Senate unanimously referred a constitutional amendment to the people that made crime victims' rights meaningful and enforceable, and it was overwhelmingly supported by the people. Second, in this session, the legislature overwhelmingly passed Senate Bill 233, which establishes procedures for the smooth integration of victims' rights into the criminal process. We've come a long way from the early days of the 1970s and early 80s when many predicted the sky would fall if victims had meaningful rights. Victims in Oregon have important rights, and the sky has not fallen on the criminal justice system. Now the federal system also has enforceable rights, and the sky has not fallen there either. Victims also have an interest in avoiding excessive delay, and a fair justice system should incorporate this value into the law. Many states provide for prompt disposition for crime victims. The sky has not fallen in those jurisdictions either. In fact, 33 states have a
statute in the law similar to this, and 12 states have it in their constitutions. House Bill 2874 will not allow any victim to rush a case through the process. It is intended for those cases in which there is excessive delay, where the state and the defendant have sufficient time to prepare. In an ideal world, we would not need this legislation because, in that ideal world, the criminal justice system would process all cases in a timely manner. However, this is not an ideal world. In that minority of cases which are unduly delayed, there should be a way of bringing that delay to the attention of the courts. House Bill 2874 puts a human face on the delay. When the state complains about a delay, it is viewed as an institutional bureaucracy that has plenty of other business to conduct, even if a particular case is continued again and again. When victims complain about delay, they are communicating the stress and anxiety that accompanies waiting too long for resolution and closure in the justice system. This law is particularly important for the most vulnerable and harmed victims among us: child victims of sexual and physical abuse, sexual assault victims, domestic violence victims, and elderly victims of crime. Where there has been excessive delay, these and other victims should be able to ask the court to move the process along. House Bill 2874 is a modest bill that allows a victim to formally question excessive delay. This is a procedure that all individuals with a stake in the criminal justice process, both defendants and victims, should have. Now, in addition to my testimony, you have testimony from Mr. John Stein, who is with the International Organization for Victims Assistance, and if I could just read one short paragraph from that letter.
Mr. Dole, I prefer not.
All right.
I've got so much more. We have
another I understand, Chair. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. I understand your time, Professor, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, Mr. Ritzit, Mr. Boquist. I'm Doug Ballouf. I'm a national expert on crime victim law, and I have drafted this bill, and then the bill has changed in consultation with prosecutors and others. The first thing I'd like to say is to clarify something before I go into the bill itself, and that is that Judge Paul Lipscomb, who recently retired from the bench to become the head of the Marion Public Defenders Consortium here, had an amendment in the Senate, which at that time I did not object to. I had assumed erroneously that the amendment was incorporated into the House bill, and my testimony, my written testimony, reflects that erroneous assumption. Gail Meyer brought to my attention that it was not incorporated, and it was Judge Lipscomb's intent to include certain language in order to provide balance for the criminal defendant. I've talked this over with Steve Dole. I have the language from the Senate here, and I'm changing my position on that from no position to supporting Judge Lipscomb's language. It's being
Doug, forwarded. I just want to set the record. You said twice in the Senate. I'm assuming this was stuff that happened in the House.
It is. Oh, I'm sorry. Stuff that happened in the
I
House.
Just want to
yes, this
make
is
sure
all
our
in
record's
the House.
Correct.
Right. All. In, sorry. Excuse me, all Chair right. Brzezinski. So with that, we forwarded that amendment. I support it. What I want to say about this bill is it's not an earth-shattering bill. It's a very modest bill. And our anecdotal information from around the country about how this law works, where it exists in other jurisdictions, is that it has been very useful in those kinds of cases that have fallen through the cracks of the judicial dockets. And we've had cases that are over 2 years old where a victim brought to the court's attention that the case had gone on for a very long time, and the court's response typically is to set a hearing. This bill limits the remedy for this right to asking the court if they would set a firm hearing date for the proceeding. I want to give the committee comfort that the defendant's constitutional due process rights trump any right of the victim to a prompt disposition. And Judge Lipscomb's suggested amendment incorporates that constitutional language into the statute as well. So this is not the kind of bill that is going to cause a revolution like so many victims' rights bills have. It is a bill that is modest, that will address the most egregious cases of delay that cause particular harm in crimes against particularly vulnerable victims. Thank you, Chair Krasanski.
Doug.
My name is Doug Harkroad, Senator Krasanski, members of the committee. I'm the retired Lane County District Attorney, and I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. We're strong supporters of victims' rights and specifically of this bill. As a prosecutor, I tried hundreds of cases, and what I know is that the defense of delay is oftentimes the only defense that the defendant has, and certainly is a defense that almost all defendants use. Memories fade and so on and so forth, and so the longer it goes, the better it is for the defendant, and the worse it is for victims, has been my experience, particularly vulnerable victims. And those would be those children that were mentioned earlier, those victims of domestic violence. I tried a case last August that had both a child in it who witnessed domestic violence and Regina, the mom, who was pretty badly beaten up. And it took us months to get that case to trial, despite my best efforts. Had I been able to say, there's a statute you can ask, we might have tried that case sooner, and it would have been better. It would have been better for her. I note that defendants that are in custody have a right to a speedy trial within 60 days. This measure doesn't go nearly that far in giving victims rights, but it does at least say that a victim has a right to a prompt disposition of the case. That's all I have.
All right. Thank you very much. Questions for anyone on this panel?
Mr. Yep. Chair, some of us sat around a table many times working on what became Senate Bill 233, and I know that the Judicial Department submitted some changes to make sure it's consistent, but I'm just a little curious about why we didn't deal with this issue in that very long discussion. Why a separate bill?
There's a very good reason why it's a separate bill, and I was intimately involved in both the Constitutional Amendment and 233. And the reason is that the Constitution, the objective of the amendment to the Constitution was simply to provide standing to victims. And the concern was if other rights were added to the Constitution, it would complicate that effort. And again, on 233, the purpose of that bill was simply to create court procedures that all parties could come together and agree upon to facilitate that process. And if other rights were put into that bill, there was a concern that it would get sidelined or distracted. So everyone had an agreement at the outset of those two efforts, both the constitutional effort and 233, to keep other substantive rights out of those bills. Hard enough to get those things done, believe me, Senator Bonamici, without adding that layer of complication. Thanks for the question.
All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. I do have Gil Meyer scheduled to testify. Was there anyone else who wanted to be giving testimony on House Bill 2874A?
Thank you. Chair Przonski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I do want to note that I think it's very accurate to say that on the House side, everybody thought that the Lipscomb Amendment language was in the final bill. I made hand notations on my -1 amendment that it was adopted by the committee on April 14th. Apparently, that's not on the official record. I don't know. I can just tell you that we were concerned that the bill on its face did not address the defendant's rights. We wanted it to. And I believe it's accurate to say the House committee really thought that it had taken care of the Lipscomb language, and so we would definitely want to see that in a final product. I want to point out what should be obvious but perhaps need to be stated and thought about more. This looks reasonable on its face, but the courts already struggle with trying to get cases out to trial. It struggles in good faith. And now we're cutting the judicial branch's budget by 15%. What we're taking is a two-party system. Each party has rights to the setting of the trial date, and now we're loading up a third entity, a third person, with rights as to the setting of the trial date. I think it's fair to say this is the first victim's right that would actually collide with the rights of the parties. So, for instance, prior victims' rights have been matters of right to information, right to be present, right to be heard, right to have transcripts. Those don't collide with other parties' rights. The setting of a trial date could collide. I do take issue with the thought that it is only the defense that's responsible for delays. It's not the case. The state needs continuances, too, and they are dedicated to the thought that the same DA that takes the case to the grand jury should be the one that tries the case, and so that you have to wait until that DA is available. I've had cases continued where the victims were in college, and I had a witness grandparent who was dying, and we couldn't set the case until the victim witness was off on spring break. So, you know, the courts struggle with this already. This will impact a system, and these systemic impacts show up later. And I do note that right now there's no appellate remedy, but in Senate Bill 233, which Senator Bonamici referred to, this is a 27-page bill that enacts 10 rights. And I don't know what's going to happen later in terms of implementing procedural enforcement mechanisms for a trial right. But I do note in 233 that what was established, and this is my suggestion to the committee, what was established in 233 was a task force under the auspices of the Attorney General. And it was designed to collect information and monitor how the implementation of victims' rights is occurring in the court system, and to elicit and solicit complaints of victims. I would submit that at this time of fiscal strain on our judicial department, where they have fewer judges rather than more, that perhaps the right fix here at this time would be to broaden the task force, or allow the task force in 233 to look at and solicit feedback from victims as to the setting of trial dates, and let's just see what kind of a problem exists.
All right, thank you. Questions for Ms. Meyer? Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2874A. We'll be carrying over House Bill 2874A to Tuesday, May 26th. And I'm also wanting to put on the record, we had three bills earlier today when Council Anna Braun was here. Those bills are House Bill 2629. That's carried over until May 26th. We have House Bill 2713 carried over until May 26th. And also House Bill 2502 will also be carried over until May 26th. For those who are wondering why we are carrying the bills over, I have one member who's not here who wants to be able to vote on some. We also have some relating clauses that we may be wanting to and needing to put other material into. And the reason we're going into the carryover mode, because this is Friday, we have to have 48 hours notice. And because of the time frame with the 25th not being here, that we'll be carrying over anything that we don't work. So for the record for today, any bill that has not been actually worked out of this committee will in fact be carried over until Tuesday, May 26th. All right, now I've got another counsel coming in, Mr. Taylor. And we're going to open up hopefully a quick hearing on House Bill 2290A. And we'll get Mr. Taylor here. And if the witnesses want to come forward, that would help expedite us.
Chair, for the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. We are speaking to Section 1 of House Bill 2290A.
And Al, before you do that, let me just have counsel just put something on the record so we know where we're starting off from.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2290A comes to you at the request of the House Interim Judiciary Committee. It allows a peace officer to cite an individual for using artificial light from a vehicle while in possession of a bow and arrow, rifle, or other firearm. Clarifies the definition of firearm to mean any weapon designed to expel a projectile by action of powder, eliminates the sunset provision on 475-235, which provides that a certified copy of forensic laboratory report signed by an analyst is prima facie evidence. Chair, members of the committee, there are a series of amendments to this bill.
All right. Thank you. We're taking testimony only today, so Al, if you can summarize yours, that'd be great.
Hey, Mr. Chair, we're speaking to Section 1. What we have is a scenario where OSP works illegal night poachers with the assistance of aircraft, and those aircraft is the pilot and the spotter, and they often see the violation, and the trooper on the ground then issues a citation. Recently, a judge dismissed the case when the judge realized that the violation was observed by the pilot but signed by the ground trooper. He based his opinion on ORS 153042, which states that a violation citation may only be issued if the conduct takes place in the presence of the enforcement officer. What Section 1 does on lines 22 to 25, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, is introduces the probable cause and allows for the violation to be seen by the aircraft pilot or spotter, and then the violation actual citation be issued by the ground trooper. That concludes my testimony on Section 1 of this bill.
Thank you. Lieutenant Steve, thank you for being here. I'm glad that we got you up at the podium. Last week we didn't have that chance, so please.
Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee, my name is Steve Lane. I'm currently assigned with Oregon State Police as the State Wildlife Lieutenant, and I'm simply here beside Mr. Elkins to answer any questions the committee may have, but this is one piece of change in the law, admitting it, that would give us one more tool to work at catching the wildlife poacher.
Thank you. And is it Emma Dutton? If you have testimony, I believe you might have handed something in.
Yes, this is on 2290-5. I'm from the Forensic Laboratory.
Uh-huh.
And this is for the extension of the Sunset Clause that was put in place on House Bill 2340. So in April of 2007, the Oregon Supreme Court issued the Birchfield decision. This net result was that the district attorneys had to subpoena all of our drug analysts to go and testify. And this was regardless of whether the crime lab report was at issue. This decision caused a number of subpoenas to increase dramatically for our drug chemists. So this has nothing to do with...
Right. Okay. No, we understand. We're going to take your testimony. Then we have a lot of amendments that are for okay. multiple bills, and we're going to deal with those on another time. I still got to get testimony on another bill in.
Okay. So, anyway, there was a House bill that was passed, 2340, which simply required the defendant to object to the use of the laboratory report as prima facie evidence not less than 15 days prior to the trial. That measure has a sunset clause that expires January 2010. We have analysts that often receive six or seven subpoenas in a day. This law will provide them a mechanism to manage their upcoming subpoenas and minimize potential for cases being dismissed because the analyst was not available.
Ms. Dutton, my understanding is that the dash fives that you're testifying to were actually adopted on the House side, and so they're already into the bill that we have before us. So I'm going to ask you to, discontinue your testimony since we've already got them into the bill and we're not looking at, unadopting them.
Okay.
All righty. Thank you. Is there any questions for this committee, or excuse me, for this panel? Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on the 2290? If not, we're going to close the public hearing on 22. Uh-oh. Looks like we got one more that wants to come up. Come on, Gil. And Ms. Meyer, let me just let you know there's going to be a number of amendments that are going to be considered with this bill. They're not being considered today. So if you're here to testify on any of those amendments.
2285 is now going
to open. Let me say my comments until you do work.
No, if you have something regarding what we've heard so far, then feel free to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. As to Section 6 of the bill, subsection 4, which extends the, whichever section it eliminates the sunset clause for the introduction of the lab technologist's report, we want to interpose our opposition to that. Am I on the right page?
No, I don't think so.
No?
This would be the right bill.
Okay, this is the right bill. Are you talking about what's in the A and Gross?
Yes.
Okay. 475. Good. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Ms. Meyer, are you talking about ORS 475-235, which provides a certified copy of forensic laboratory report?
Yes, yes. Okay. Isn't that in the bill?
That is in the bill.
Page 5, bottom.
On page 5. We would just like to register our opposition.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Meyer? All right. Thank you very much. And with that, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2298. And this bill will also be carried over until this next Tuesday, May 26. And now we're going to start our I believe, our last public hearing. This is on House Bill 2335A.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2335A states that after decision by the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision not to grant parole to an inmate, a subsequent parole hearing may not be held sooner than 2 years after denial and no later than 10 years from the date in which the prisoner is sentenced to life or sentenced as a dangerous offender or sentenced for the crime committed prior to November 1, 1989. Chair, members of the committee, this bill comes to you from the Oregon District Attorneys Association.
All right, I have a number of individuals who want to give testimony today. What I'm going to let the witnesses know is that our committee normally closes at 10. The chair is going to stay here to take testimony. I don't know how many of my members are going to be able to stay along, but we'll continue to get the testimony in today. And we have to be on the floor, I believe, at 10:15. So you may be seeing some people leave. I will probably be asking to be excused at the beginning. So with that, I'm going to start with Steve Dole. Darian, I've seen you in the room. And did you have, let's go ahead and bring up Tiffany back up. That would be all right. I think I'll start off like that. And then we'll bring in the other victim witnesses in the next panel.
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Darian Stanford, and I am a deputy district attorney with Multnomah County, and I'm here today to testify about House Bill 2335, and in the interest of time, I'm going to try to be as remarkably brief as I can. When I left the Senate Judiciary Committee in 2007, I returned to Multnomah County DA's office, and the first project that I was given was working on a case by the name of Richard Troy Gilmore and learning about the Oregon Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. 2 years later, I know a little bit about it. I'm going to try to summarize what I've learned to help your understanding of this bill in about a five-minute time span. It's stated as succinctly as possible. Right now, under present law, every person that the Oregon Board of Parole looks at, considers, if they deny parole, they get a rehearing within 2 years, no matter what. This bill says if the board makes certain specific findings, that two-year period can stay at 2 years or it can go as high as 10 years. That's what it does. So what I'd like to do, just because the parole board is sort of an arcane creature, is to give a basic understanding of what it is that the board does. There are three types of people that go before the board. And those are Category 1, persons convicted of aggravated murder or murder. Category 2 are persons that are classified as what is known as a dangerous offender. Dangerous offender refers to persons convicted of a Class A felony that in seriously endangered life, and the dangerous offenders have a severe personality disorder indicating a propensity toward crimes that seriously endanger the lives of others. So you could have, for example, Richard Gilmore was sentenced for rape, was convicted of rape, and he was also classified as a dangerous offender. That's Category 2. Category 3 refers to what we know as pre-matrix offenders. Those are persons who committed felonies prior to November 1, 1989, when Oregon adopted the sentencing guidelines grid. So if you committed your felonies prior to this time, you would be receiving what was known as an indeterminate sentence. Now, that third category should necessarily be dwindling in number, although there are some cold cases that are sometimes brought forward. But those are the three categories of persons that we're talking about when we talk about who's appearing before the parole board. And the considerations for each are slightly different. For aggravated murder or murder, what the board is looking at, the technical term is a change in terms of confinement rather than parole, but the board's trying to consider, is the person likely to be rehabilitated? That's the question. For dangerous offenders, the question is the person either no longer dangerous, or are they still dangerous, but they can adequately be controlled in the community through necessary treatment and resources? For pre-matrix offenders, the board must find that the person has a severe emotional disturbance such as to constitute a danger. So that's what we're looking at. Those are the criteria that apply to each one of these classes of persons. So if a person is denied parole or a change in terms of confinement under existing law, all three of those classes of people right now, as a matter of law, get another hearing in 2 years. What 2335 does is it says, you know, you can keep it at two, but if you make the requisite specific findings and you articulate those findings in writing, you can extend that time period for a rehearing all the way out to 10 years. And again, I repeat, if you extend beyond two, the board has to make a specific finding that it is not reasonable that the person was going to be granted parole within that requisite time period anyway. If you also, a second key in this bill, if the board sets the time for a rehearing beyond 2 years, if they set it 3, 5, 7, the person, the inmate, still has the right to petition for a hearing at every 2-year interval, just like they have under current law. If their board finds reasonable cause to believe that the inmate might succeed and that circumstances have changed, they'll get their hearing within 2 years, as opposed to going all the way out to 10. That was one of a few legislative amendments in the House that, in the version that was finally passed. Again, if you move beyond 2 years, you need a specific order with findings of fact and conclusions of law. There were a number of challenges that were brought in terms of constitutional concerns, ex post facto. I would imagine the opponents will address that. All I'll say about this is there's an opinion from Legislative Counsel Joshua Nasby, that appears to suggest that the bill, as amended, would meet the requisite challenges under Article 1, Section 9 of the U.S. Constitution and Article 1, Section 21 of the Oregon Constitution. I would also refer you to Representative Barton's floor statement when the bill passed 54-3 through the House. He strongly endorsed the constitutionality. It's something we took very seriously. The bill went through a series of, I believe, 6 amendments in the House to make certain that this bill would stand up to tests. The last thing that I'll mention on this, two last things, in terms of costs, the bill, we worked very closely with the board that Nancy Sellers and Steve Powers, who are here, to try to minimize any costs to the parole board. And the bill originally had a referral, prior referral, to Ways and Means Committee. Because we were able to minimize any costs through the board, I think the official fiscal was an indeterminate. Speaker Hunt, rescinded the referral to Ways and Means, and so the bill was able to go directly to the House floor. We did everything we could to keep costs absolutely minimal. Last thing that I'll say is it's appropriate that this bill is being considered today as you consider House Bill 3263. You heard from Danielle Tudor and Tiffany Edens, two people that I had the pleasure to work with closely on the Gilmore case, about what the impact of Gilmore on their lives was. For Danielle, she can never see him prosecuted. That's what the ex post facto law guarantees, is that we can't go back and now prosecute Richard Gilmore. We can't change the rules after the fact. This bill is one way to help Danielle by saying we can't prosecute him, but maybe we can make it to where you don't have to face him every 2 years to relive the crimes that happened to you. It's a very small step, but a very important one. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Krasanski and other chair members. My name is Tiffany Edens, and this bill personally affects me. I was really going to try not to get upset about this, but the last year and a half of my life and my family's life has been changed. I was raped when I was 13 years old and had to go through a trial. And Des Connell represented Richard Gilmore. Thank you. And did the continuances, so I know what they were talking about in the bill that was talked about before. And that was horrible. But to deal with 23 years later, to have to be in the same room with Richard Gilmore and to hear him rant and rave and make excuses and promote lies. It insulted me, especially when the inmate requests a parole consideration hearing. They go through a process of creating a parole plan. And in that, they also have to have psychological evaluations. and these psychological evaluations give a report onto what the status is of these inmates. Gilmore's status was still a danger to community, 50% recidivism within 5 years, 70% recidivism within 10 years, sexual sadistic, narcissistic, antisocial. Why did we have to go before the parole board when they already had this information? They weren't going to, well, excuse me, they did let him out, but not with due process. They were going to let him out, but I fought that, and that was taken care of, but that's not what I'm here to talk about. But, you know, there are people like Richard Gilmore. There's a lot more. There's about 1,600 inmates that go before the parole board, and that is 1,600 victims plus. That if there can be a screening process, if they already know that this person is sick, and I'm sorry, Darian, where in my case, where a dangerous offender, where they have to prove that they no longer have the mental defect or whatever, I'm sorry to paraphrase, but why do they put the victim through all that time and all that prep and all that? I mean, the hearing in June was 10 hours long. I had to be in a room about the first one. I was probably as far from that camera guy to Gilmore, sitting at one table. The second one, I was about as far as you and I right now, Senator. And he was sick, and he was a risk. And I just feel that this House bill is appropriate for those cases that are high profile, that have diagnoses and the access to, I think that's the term. But I support this bill, and I believe that it will stop the unnecessary grief and panic for victims and their families. And I assume that it will save the state money and man hours in the parole board, because they won't have to go through all of the parole hearings. And I know that that takes a lot of time and a lot of effort and a lot of money. So, I mean, I'm not a finance major or anything, but it just seems logical to me. So I appreciate it, and I'm sorry that I got a little upset there. But
no problem.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Dole.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Dole with Crime Victims United. I'm going to defer my time to two gentlemen that drove, one from Seattle today, the other one from Eugene, Dr. Jack Clark. This concerns the case of little Jessica Clark, a three-year-old who was murdered in Columbia County back in 1979. Dr. Jack Clark, her uncle is here today to testify, and her father, who drove from Seattle, David. The only thing I would ask very quickly is, you have some testimony from Doug and Edie Richard that I handed in. I'd ask you to read all of it, but particularly the fourth paragraph on the first page, and I thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Can I ask a very quick question?
You may.
Darian and Tiffany, thank you, and please don't apologize for getting upset. Certainly.
This really affected me badly.
I don't understand. I've never been involved in one of these. Did you need to testify at that, or did you just feel like you needed to be there to keep an eye on what was going on? I think it must have been dreadful to be in the same room.
When I was raped, I believe that the day before a House bill or a statute went through, Crime Victims' Rights Act, and that ensured that I could be notified of parole hearings, I could give a statement. Now, when in October, when the first hearing that I was at, I did two hearings in 8 months because of legal issues. But I was going to have my husband make the statement, but I decided that I had a powerful voice and that I could be this. I could do the speaking, and so a victim has a choice if they're going to make that statement or not. But
it's more of a statement, and then the parole
board does ask you questions. I was asked questions after I gave my statement. I spoke for about 45 minutes at the hearing in June, and Gilmore spoke for about 4 hours. The hearing in October, I spoke for probably about 20 minutes. I was told that I should only speak for 3 minutes, but I went ahead and kept speaking. And he again spoke for probably about 3 hours. So it's a long time, and it's disheartening, and it's very upsetting.
All right. Thank you all very much for coming forward. I am going to call as our next panel Jack Clark, David Clark, and Doug Harkerode. And committee, we've made a call down to the Secretary of the Senate to let them know we're still going, but if you feel that you need to go to the floor, feel free to do so.
Chairman Przanski and members of the community, members of the committee, excuse me, my name is Jack Clark, and I'm the uncle of Jessica Clark. I'd just like to give you a little synopsis of the crime and what we have gone through in the 30 years since. In 1979, my 3-year-old niece Jessica Clark was walking next door to play with her friend. On the way, she happened to encounter, to her misfortune, her friend's 19-year-old cousin, Richard Brian Bird. According to court records at that particular time, Mr. Bird was masturbating in the woodshed when Jessica walked by the door. Mr. Bird, who'd been drinking and doing drugs for several days and was mad at the world, according to his account, decided he couldn't let Jessica live after what she had seen. So he strangled her. He stomped on her. When she didn't die, he climbed up on the wood chopping block and jumped off into the middle of her back. There was so much force implied to this poor child's rib cage that at autopsy, there was dirt and wood chips clear to the bottom of her lungs. Jessica still clung to life, so Mr. Bird carried her out into a horse pasture and dumped her body there, hoping that the horses would step on her, thereby confusing the cause of death and hiding his crime. Well, the law did catch up Mr. Bird, and there was a trial. Eventually, he did confess to the crime. He was tried. He was found guilty by a jury of his peers, and he was sentenced to death. I'm no lawyer. I'm a doctor. But my understanding is all death sentences are automatically appealed, as was his. Again, he was sentenced to death. He was found guilty. He was sentenced to death a second time. While Mr. Bird was on death row, the Oregon Supreme Court threw out the death penalty. This effectively changed his sentence to life without the possibility of parole. That's all well and good to this point. But, unfortunately, that's not the end of the story. A lawyer filed a motion for a retrial based on the possibility that the jury might have glimpsed Mr. Bird in leg irons, even though he sat behind a skirted table through the whole trial, both trials. The assumption was that if the jury saw him wearing leg irons, they would say, well, if he's wearing leg irons, he must be guilty, therefore confusing the whole thing. Once again, there was a trial. Once again, he was found guilty and sentenced to life. But now, and here's the rub. Because he was granted a new trial, he's automatically assumed to be innocent. The first two trials don't count. So when he was convicted for a third time, the sentence again was life, but this time the provision of without the possibility of parole is dropped. So after serving a few years mandatory prison time, he's now eligible for parole. I told you all this to tell you one more thing. When Mr. Bird got a life sentence, so did Jessica's family. No, we don't have to live in the prison, but we do have to live in its shadow. Every 2 years, we must gather at the prison, some of us traveling over 100 miles to get there, to attend Mr. Bird's parole hearing. We must submit to the humiliation of entering the prison, which includes wearing certain clothes, being searched, going through the metal detector, being locked up like a regular criminal behind the multiple doors, And we were told at the time, if we are, if there's a riot and we're captured, we're just, they can't guarantee our safety. We must sit in a room, like the young lady spoke just a minute ago, we must sit in a room so close to the man who killed our loved one, we can smell his sweat. We must listen to him tell again and again and again all the grisly details of how he killed her, why he killed her, making excuses that society is to blame. He is the victim here because society failed him. We have gone to the prison 9 times. 9 times we've done this. We have to go because we have to speak for Jessica. She cannot speak for herself. In March 2011, we will go again for the 10th time. If we succeed in keeping him behind bars for 2 more years, in 2013, we'll do it again, and we'll do it again, and we'll do it again. There is no healing for us. There is no closure. Every 2 years, we must go to the prison, relive the crime. Every 2 years, we must pick the scab off the wound and bleed again. Every 2 years, Jessica's mother, her father, her aunts, her uncles, her cousins, find themselves once again falling into the depression that severely affects our home lives, our families, our personal relationships, and even our jobs. And for what? Nothing ever changes. Every hearing starts the same way. They read the psychologist's report. The psychologist reports the same as it was the other 9 times. Mr. Bird is not fit to live outside of prison walls. He is a threat to society. He has a very high probability to react with violence if put under stress. The doctor recommends he should be incarcerated for another 2 years. Occasionally, they even recommend as many as 5 years. After 2 or 3 more hours of questioning, the board convenes, they find him guilty, they remand him for 2 more years, and so are we. So why not change this? Why not give those of us who are serving a life sentence for being victims a chance to live some semblance of a normal life? We know there are people in prison who will never qualify for parole, and they shouldn't. So why force the victims to endure this process every 2 years? Why spend much-needed tax dollars and the parole board's time going through this same old jury process when the outcome's going to be the same? House Bill 2335 will address this problem. It does not apply to all convicts. Only those who have had many chances to show themselves worthy of a parole and have repeatedly failed. House Bill 2335 would give those of us who haven't committed a crime more time between parole hearings, give us a chance to get on with our lives without this cloud constantly hanging over our heads. I want to thank you for your time and your consideration of this bill, and I hope it'll be a positive one. Thank you.
Thank you. David, did you want to make any comments?
Yeah, just very briefly. I just wanted to say that, you know, I made this trip here.
Oh, David, I do need you to put your full name on the record. I apologize.
It's David L. Clark. I'm Jessica's father. And I just want you to, I just made this trip because I want you guys to understand, and it has been spoken here already, how emotionally devastating it is. To the victim's family, they have to go through this every 2 years, to sit in a room and listen to the man that killed your daughter describe in minute detail how he did it and why he did it and what he was thinking, and to have to go through that again and again every 2 years. And like my brother said, we've been doing this since 1993. And the only reason that we're doing this is because the parole board doesn't have the authority to change it. And so I'm just here to urge you to give them that authority. Thank you.
Thank you for coming forward, and thank you for traveling the distance you did to give your testimony. And to your brother, Jack, thank you as well. Doug?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Doug Harkelrode, as you know. I'm the retired Lean County District Attorney, and I represent the Oregon Anti-Crime Alliance. This bill's personal for me. There's a man, now long since retired. His name is Fred Hughey. Fred Hughey was a prosecutor in the Lane County District Attorney's Office. I worked with him so long ago, I was a deputy DA there, and we had offices next to each other. I went to law school with Mr. Hughey. Fred Hughey got the assignment to prosecute Diane Downs, and he spent a tremendous amount of time, energy, and effort, and emotion dealing with that case. He was successful in that prosecution. Diane Downs was sentenced to life in prison, mandatory minimum of 25 years. Diane Downs killed one of her children and seriously injured the other two, shot them. Those children eventually came up for adoption, and there were no takers for these damaged kids, physically and emotionally damaged kids. Mr. Hughey and his wife Joanne adopted those children. You want to talk about victim services in a DA's office? That's victim services. I'm pleased to report both of those children have graduated from college. Mr. Hughey never wanted anything to do with the media as it would periodically contact our office, and I did the best I could to protect him. We continued to do that 25 years after she was sentenced, because it was now time for the parole hearing. So one of our senior lawyers, another lawyer, Paul Grabner, did an excellent job of rounding up significant information about what she had done in 25 years in various prisons around this country, because she wasn't kept in Oregon. Her escape attempts, the fact that she had a child when she got out of prison, or she escaped, got pregnant, had a child at public expense. There was nothing about Diane Downs that was going to have the parole board let her out. Well, this bill would give the parole board the opportunity to tell Mr. Hughey and those kids, you don't have to worry about this in 2 years, if in fact there's sufficient information and evidence for them. So I helped Darian Stanford and Crime Victims United and others in a small way to try to craft a bill that would be constitutional, that would not lengthen any sentences, but would give the parole board discretion to set a parole hearing somewhere between 2 and 10 years. And I'd suggest this is a good bill and it should become law. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Gentlemen, again, thank you very much for coming here and sharing your personal stories. All right, I have one other panel for today that's signed up, and that's going to be Stephen Powers, Shannon White, and Gil Meyer. And Stephen, I'm going to let you go first, since you're signed up neutral. Yes. Just for the committee, we did call down at 10 o'clock, and we are excused from the floor for those who want to stay, but also understand you may have other commitments that may need you to leave.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. For the record, I'm Stephen Powers, chairperson of the Oregon Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision. I'm here in a neutral capacity and to provide background information on the hearings affected by House Bill 2335A. As was stated earlier, the board has release authority over approximately 10% of those offenders incarcerated in the Department of Corrections. They're outlined in my written testimony in the three general categories. Something to point out, though, is two of those three categories are existing law crimes, and so you can have crimes committed today or 2 years ago, and the board can have release authority over them. Most people think of the parole board as an anachronism or something that's going to be phased out over time. That's not true under Oregon sentencing policy as it exists today. Two of those three categories, the dangerous offenders and the aggravated murderers and murderers who are ultimately eligible, will have parole hearings, and so we're talking about scheduling hearings for 2030 and beyond. Also noted in my written testimony, and I won't go into detail about it, is that the constitutional limitations the board has in making its release decisions. These parole hearings, for the most part, in two of the three categories, are automatic. It's not something that the parole board schedules. It's something that the law presumed at some point they would be eligible for parole, and therefore the parole board is tasked with that hearing of creating the hearing packet and setting up the hearing schedule to be held every 2 years. There are obviously constitutional implications to changing any of those procedures, and the baseline is that the parole board cannot change the substantive standard but can make procedural changes. The board estimates that it will hold about 400 hearings in the 09-11 biennium, and for the last two calendar years, the board has held 429 hearings, and we've had victims or their representatives participate in about 14%. That's in person or by telephone. That 14% statistic, however, does not include the number of hearings in which a victim participated by submitting a written statement to the board or by contacting board staff for information and updates.
Mr. Powers, as you stated, you do have written testimony. What I'm going to ask you to do is let the committee see if they have any questions, and would you be available to come back if there are questions that we'd like to ask you based on what your written testimony is?
I would be available to come back, absolutely.
If you'd like to summarize.
Yeah, and so what I was going to point out, though, is that 14% statistic obviously affects a lot more. So the two competing policy choices, or at least two of the many competing policy choices, are encapsulated at the end of the written testimony, and that is that the board understands that the very nature of parole hearings are highly traumatic to victims and co-victims because the board asks the offenders to discuss intimate details of the crime and at times provide a step-by-step recount of what has happened, and then looking at their present circumstances through the number of years that they've been incarcerated. And so we understand that victims who appear in person or by telephone or who are otherwise interested in the case are no less affected by the potential of a hearing. On the other hand, the board understands the transformative nature of its hearings. This is one of the few places that offenders are directly questioned about their progress. And so this can be an important component about an offender's path towards the constitutional goal of reformation. Ultimately, as I said, the board is neutral, and I would be available to come back and answer questions at the committee's convenience.
All right. Thank you. Are there any questions from Mr. Powers at this time? Thank you very much. Ladies, whoever would like to go next.
Go next. Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, thank you. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We'd like to give our appreciation to Representative Brent Barton and Chris Garrett on the House side for all the work they did. The product that you're receiving is very much improved, and there has been a lot of care and attention given to our concerns over the ex post facto implications of adjusting the parole eligibility and the parole date hearing dates. I wish that our member, Bronson James, could have been here this morning. He would have articulated for you his concerns. He is the chief deputy at the Appellate Division of the Public Defense Services. His comments on the House side were as good as this bill might read, and it's substantially better than the original bill. His office will of necessity need to challenge any of these denials of settings of hearings on ex post facto grounds. It will substantially burden their office and create a lot more litigation around this area. And so it will have a fiscal impact in that respect. As to my other comments, I'll just wait then. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Shannon?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, I'm Shannon White with Partnership for Safety and Justice, and we'll try and be brief, recognizing that y'all are running late. I am here to testify in opposition to House Bill 2335. But first want to recognize that parole hearings can be an incredibly difficult process for victims, and we believe that efforts must be made to minimize the victim's trauma during parole board hearings. And in fact, we have participated in the parole board work group, which actually sought and is proceeding on recommendations to mitigate some of the trauma that's been expressed here today. We believe further that it is mostly necessary, and the parole board has sought additional funds for the parole board to have services to help support victims throughout the process. We actually believe that victims need to have support services from the time of the crime till any point in their life when they might need it, including throughout the parole board process, and that it's that lack of services that's really missing. And it certainly is, and was identified by our work group.
Shannon, I hate to say this. It sounds like the Senate's looking for a quorum to be able to actually start conducting the business. Because of that, I need you to wrap up very quickly. If necessary, we'll have you come back and complete your testimony on Tuesday.
Yep. Okay. Well, let me just read my closing remark, and then maybe if I can go back Tuesday as well, just to get it out there. I just want to say again that we were a member of this Pro Board work group, and that we believe that this policy change, first of all, it's not being requested specifically by the parole board, nor is it identified in a comprehensive work group. And especially given the leadership change at the parole board, we think it's untimely and doesn't really address the needs in the system, with both for services for victims and also for people who are imprisoned who are not getting the rehabilitative services they need. And right now, this is sort of the only contact they get with how to improve their rehabilitation.
All right. Thank you. I'm sorry to rush you. I have no one else that was scheduled to testify, at least signed up for 2335A. If there is someone else in the room that wants to, you will need to come back on Tuesday. We're carrying over this bill till Tuesday, May 26th. And for the record, we have two other bills that we have not gotten to, House Bill 3295 and House Bill 2285. Those two bills will also be carried over till Tuesday, May 26th. Again, just in closing, any bill that was not voted out of this committee today that's on the agenda, revised agenda number 6, will be carried over until this next Tuesday, May 26th. With that, is there anything else we need to cover? With that, we're adjourned, and colleagues, thank you very much for staying for the testimony.